Well, I would like to go now to some other aspects of your activity. And as a physicist, you are one of very few physicists, really, who has been closely related to both Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein. Can you please characterize by what you have been most influenced when having been in contact with Niels Bohr on one hand and with Albert Einstein then later on the other hand?
It's been a wonderful inspiration to know both men. I first came to know Einstein in 1935 on my first visit to Princeton. No, actually 1934, very shortly after he had come to the United States. And then in 1953, I remember when I first started to teach relativity, that although it was only a few months before his death, he was kind enough to invite me to bring my students around to his house for tea. So we sat around the dining room table, and his secretary, Helen Dukas, and his stepdaughter, Margot Einstein, brought tea, and the students asked Einstein questions. One of them, Professor Einstein, what do you think about the nature of electricity? And he told about his thoughts over the years about electricity. And another one, Professor Einstein, do you agree with the idea of an expanding universe? And of course he did. And then another student, Professor Einstein, you had so much to do with the quantum theory, and why don't you agree with the quantum theory? And then Einstein said again, as he did so often, his famous words, I do not believe that God plays dice.
Yeah.
And finally, one student got up his courage and he said, Professor Einstein, when you are no longer living, what will happen to this house? And Einstein gave a great big laugh and he threw up his hands and his hearty voice, and he spoke with a childlike simplicity and a smile on his face and bright eyes. And his choice of words was always so careful and so beautiful. This house will never become a place of pilgrimage where the pilgrims come to look at the bones of the saint. And so it is today. The tourist buses drive up in front of his house and people get out and photograph the outside, but they don't go in the inside. And then Bohr with the great leader of physics. I went to Copenhagen, and I can remember as a student applying for a fellowship, the words I put down in my application for the fellowship, why I wanted to go. That was in 1934, the end of 1934. Why did I want to go to work with Bohr in Copenhagen? It was because he has the power to see farther ahead in physics than any other man alive. And his great gift of seeing so deeply into nuclear physics, when I was there in Copenhagen, that was the moment when the results on the capture of slow neutrons came. And Bohr immediately got terribly concerned about it and walked up and down, talked and discussed, and then one could see then the liquid drop model of the nucleus taking place right there. For him, no physics was of any interest unless there was some paradox in it or some beautiful way of seeing things simply. And of course, at his institute with somebody about to give a seminar. Somebody could start to give a seminar. He might be able to speak 5 minutes at the seminar, even though he was the invited speaker. He might be able to speak 15 minutes before Bohr took over and was immediately discussing the meaning of his results and what they proved and what they didn't prove. But then, of course, I got involved with Bohr in nuclear fission at the time when he brought the word of the discovery of fission to the United States on the 16th of January in 1939. I was down at the pier, of the steamship pier in New York, and when he came down off the ship, I shook hands to him and he said hello, and then he took me aside and he told me that just before he left Copenhagen, they'd heard about the discovery of fission. So we dropped everything else and started to work on fission. I can remember rushing, we'd worked at night as well as in the day, rushing up the steps in the library from my office to the library to see, look at the dictionary, to see if there was a better word than fission, because fission had the unfortunate property that it, the noun was all right, but there was no good verb. A nucleus fissions is not a very nice verb, but we stayed with fission in spite of that. But then I can remember also during the war meeting him in Washington. At the time he was dividing his time between Los Alamos and Washington after he had escaped from Denmark in a small boat over the sea into Sweden. And he told me confidentially about his discussions with President Roosevelt about the future of nuclear energy. And he told me about his efforts to arrange some control of nuclear energy after the war. And he said, it may seem strange, how can such a man as I, referring to himself, Niels Bohr, speak to the president of the greatest country in the world at the time of the greatest war in the history of the world. But he said, I put it to him simply in terms of what the problem is and what other possibility is there than this. And it made a great impression on Roosevelt, and they had several discussions. And the last speech that Roosevelt wrote, he died while he was still working on the speech, had in it some words about, quoted by Roosevelt from Thomas Jefferson, about how as scientists serve as the most important means of communication and bringing peace between the different countries of the world. But it was enormously impressive to me to see Bohr's courage in facing up to what the great questions are. I can remember his particularly saying to me at one time, I must seem always to you like an amateur, but I am always an amateur. And of course, that's a very modest way to say that one is a pioneer, an explorer.
Yeah.
If you work in something new, why, then you are necessarily an amateur. But to me, the debate between Bohr and Einstein over the years is the greatest debate in all the history of human thought. I can't think of any more wonderful than that. It took place for a number of years in Europe and then for a number of years in America. But unfortunately the artists of the West seem not to be so much aware of science. But in 1971, on my last visit to Moscow, I visited a studio where in the basement of an apartment house where two sculptors were making sculptures of artists and poets and great thinkers and great scientists. And there was a sculpture of Bohr and Einstein debating, and it was wonderful to see that. But I did not tell the sculptor about one of the times when Bohr came to visit the house of Einstein that I just mentioned, and he went up the stairs to the second floor where Einstein's study was, and it was a terribly hot day, and he found Einstein lying on the sofa with not one piece of clothing on. Well, they continued the debate in that frame of reference. The sculptor did not know that. But the debate, in my mind, concerns the deepest thing in all of physics, this unifying, the quantum principle, the overarching principle of 20th century physics. And as you know, in Europe, the debate focused on Einstein's belief that quantum theory was inconsistent, and so he tried to prove it was inconsistent. And then there was the famous Solvay Congress, and you know the experiment, the idealized experiment, and how dramatic it was when Bohr turned the tables on Einstein and used the general relativity to prove that Einstein's scheme would not work. But then came, after Einstein came to the United States, Einstein had given up trying to prove that the quantum theory is inconsistent, and he now was trying to prove that the quantum theory was incompatible with any reasonable idea of reality. And then was the Einstein-Rosen-Podolsky paradox and such things. Well, one has to go down through the years until one can look back and know which is the greatest man, because we know each new generation has a new insight on the history. But to me, the two men had so much in common. They were so happy talking with each other, and they were always concerned with the deepest problems, not only problems of physics, but the deepest problems of mankind. Einstein was more a man who